This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
What I know in isiXhosa, Gwedini, is a small boy. And so the whole process of circumcision is the transitioning of that small boy into manhood. And it's quite a grueling process because the circumcision itself is just an act. But what happens around that moment of circumcision are weeks and days of preparation, conversation, tutelage for young men to understand the responsibilities of manhood. And a lot of it happens away from the conventional society, away from the comforts of home, in what we call proverbially the bush, in a circumcision school. And then there's the act of circumcision at the end of this process of teaching and learning and becoming. And this is why I think for many Xhosa men, to be referred to as inkwenkwenkwedini is such an insult because of what they've had to go through in the process of preparing to become a man, which culminates in this circumcision. And we know that these rites of passage are performed in South Africa, mainly around the winter months. I'm not sure why that is in itself, but mainly around the winter months. I've heard that the wounds heal faster in the cold. Less chance of an infection or getting septic. But it happens in the winter months where young men transition from boyhood to manhood. But we also know that many tragedies happen at the circumcision training schools. Many young boys do not come back from the bush. And this is what the song is about. It's the wail of a mother crying at the risks, inherent risks in transitioning her son from boyhood to manhood, from childhood to growth, but also the fact that he might not come back home, let alone home, a man having left as a boy. And so the haunting voice is the cry of a mother really and truly having immense pity but pride for her son as well. Now, in this conversation, because every year we hear about things going wrong at circumcision schools, but we thought, you know what, to coincide with Sierra Leone, that has just introduced a ban on child marriage, which basically is an issue that has afflicted young girls in that part of West Africa and the Sahel. We thought we should bring these two issues together because in other parts of Africa, there has been a big lobby against female genital mutilation and child marriages. So Sierra Leone has just promulgated a law banning child marriages. It's something that our news team's been reflecting on. But earlier this year, particularly in March, there've been a series of protests in the Gambia where activists have been calling for a law that banned female genital mutilation to not be repealed. In fact, there were some lawmakers in the Gambia who wanted the ban to be lifted. Beggars belief, you know, on female genital mutilation. And female genital mutilation is a form of circumcision for women where young girls are then transitioned from girlhood to womanhood. And shortly after this FMG is performed, they are then married off. And we're talking girls as young as 9, 10, 11, 12 years old here. That's what we mean by child marriage. And it's become a huge moral outrage in the world and increasingly in a lot of the African countries where this is performed. The first African country to outlaw female genital mutilation was the Sudan. That was in the 1940s. And then a long time passed before any other nation did anything about it. And then it happened in Senegal in 1999. And then, ironically, in the Gambia, on the 18th of March 2024, this year, they wanted to hold a vote to lift the ban. In other words, to reinstate it. So there's a lot going on with children on the African continent. And this culture is centered very much around what circumcision represents for young men transitioning to boys, transitioning to manhood, and for girls transitioning to womanhood. Professor Tamsin Bradley, she joins us. She's the co-director of the Center for Advancement of Equality, Gender and Inclusion Studies at the University of Portsmouth. Thank you so much for coming through, Tamsin.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, I mean, I'm just going to use the broad term circumcision. Most cultures perform it. Jewish babies, you know, are circumcised within the first 10 days of birth. This is not unique to Africa, but there's something that's a little awry around circumcision, if that's the right word to use. And could you explain to us why that is?
So just a little bit of context in terms of how female circumcision, or as I prefer to call it, female genital mutilation, is now being framed within global advocacy circles. So FGM, particularly the form of circumcision that's performed on young girls and young women now, is really regarded to be a form of very extreme violence and child abuse. So we're now in a context where we've moved away from seeing FGM as a cultural practice, as something that honours a transition into adulthood. And the practice now is reframed, and has been for a while, through UNICEF categorisation as a form of violence. So I think it's really important that the discourse around the practice really foregrounds, you know, the reality and the, as you've already in your quite powerful introduction have conveyed, the devastating and violent and lasting medical trauma that this practice undertakes. So that's my first point. And in terms of understanding the why it happens, again, we have to drill deep into the constructions of gender, which is not unique to African context. This is global. You know, violence against women and girls is a global epidemic. And again, we need to frame in that way. And why do these forms of violence happen? They happen because across context, there's a fundamental devaluing of women and girls, and even more specifically, the female body, that becomes the focus of so much scrutiny and so much discipline, which ultimately leads to the sanctioning and legitimization of multiple forms of violence that a girl and a woman will endure through her life. So FGM is just one example of that brutality.
Okay. And so obviously you're focused very much on what is happening to the young girl. And as you're saying, globally now, there's an advocacy that's growing to deem this one of the most violent acts against a young girl, regardless of culture, colour or creed. It's now being taken up. And I know it's been taken up even at UN level. There's been a lot of discussion at that multilateral level. What do you make of, you know, the gendered politics or the gendered justifications, shall we say that, around male circumcision? Because it's a huge cultural practice as well in many parts of the world. In South Africa at this time, we're in our southern hemisphere winter. This is where we see a lot of young boys, urban and rural, being sent to the proverbial bush for this male training, which ultimately leads to the circumcision.
So I think, once again, I mean, there's a movement within the discourse on male circumcision that makes very similar arguments that it needs to be reframed as a form of violence and subjugation. I think what's different in terms of comparing female mutilation with male forms is really, again, the kind of gendered narrative that surrounds it. I mean, FGM really takes place as a mechanism for communicating a particular idea about women's inferior role and disempowerment. It's a tool for disempowerment. So in the case, arguably, and I'm not an expert in male circumcision, so I would not want to overstep on my expertise, but I think it's important to look at the different framing and discourse and explanations in terms of why male circumcision takes place. But I know within the movement for change, there's a similar drive to really start to look at it as violence. And I think it's possible to do that and to challenge that it should take place at all, to do that without taking away from the importance of recognizing and respecting that movement from childhood into adulthood.
You've said something really interesting, Professor Tamsin Bradley, which had never really crossed my mind, and I wonder if it had crossed the minds of others, is the framing of the rationale, rather, of why certain things happen. So my understanding of what you've just said, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, is that male circumcision, even if it's violent and it can be tragic and lead to many, many unforeseen accidents, the whole idea of sending a boy into the bush to be circumcised is that he's transitioning from boyhood to manhood, is that once he's circumcised, he becomes a bona fide man, a bona fide leader, warrior, head of household, virile. He can now go and procreate and have as many babies as he wants. So there's quite a positive messaging around it. Whereas when you read up on female genital mutilation, the parts of her anatomy that are mutilated is designed to shrink her, actually. It's designed to make her less of a sexual being. Her job is merely to be someone's wife and the mother of their children. It's supposed to suppress her sexuality, actually, are the things I've read about female genital mutilation.
Yes, absolutely. And I think we need to, read practices as forms of communication and forms of socialization, and to drill in, so what are the messages that are being communicated by these very important stages in an individual's life? And I think that's where we can see the differences, that the particular gendered messages that are being communicated in male circumcision and female circumcision mutilation are different. And we need to think in terms of life course, the impact that those messages have for the life opportunities, expectations, issues around agency and empowerment that has for boys into men, girls into women. And they are very different. And that's why for those of us that are campaigning against female genital mutilation, we're really pushing for gender transformation. And I think if we push for gender transformation, what we will actually, or gender equity, as a result of that transformation, is that we will see the challenge towards forms of violence that men are subjected to, that boys are subjected to, will also be transformed as part of that process.
Okay. So, it's interesting to me that female genital mutilation is something that African governments have grappled with for close on to a century in terms of what we understand as the formalized nation state. So maybe communities and societies have been dealing and discussing this issue for longer than that. But within the context of a modern country, modern democracy, this has really been one of those issues that many nations have been struggling with. And as I said, Sudan outlawed it in the 1940s. Senegal did it in 1999, which is, just recently. And this year alone, just this year on the 18th of March 2024, the Gambia had a situation where there was a motion in parliament to lift the ban on female genital mutilation, and it was met by protests from many activists in the country to say, no, we keep the ban. So it becomes now one of those things that is contentious in modern societies. Why?
I think what we're seeing is that dynamics of change and transformation are highly fraught, complex and actually fragile, and the Gambia situation is really a poignant one. If we really drill into where this backlash, and by the way, there's a global backlash to gender equity and move towards greater gender equity. So there are many examples all over the world of where we can see conservative and gendered kind of right-wing attitudes really now rising in power against this more liberating force that wants to see equality across the board. And I think that's what we see in the Gambia. So the framing of that backlash is really focused around this one particular form of violence, which is seen, obviously, for those that are campaigning for it, it to be restored as an important tradition, as an important practice. So we need to really look carefully and critically at how narratives around tradition and culture are manipulated, particularly by more right-wing and conservative leaders and influencers, unfortunately, who really are using that framing to try and dissuade at community level, families and individuals and change agents for really pushing towards a much more gender equal society. So I think that's what the situation in the Gambia really tells us. It also really exposes, interestingly, the tensions at various levels, from global advocacy platforms that we've spoken to already, down to the framing and support that's given to national organisations, civil society, women-led organisations, which have been massively influential in places like the Gambia, and seeing the law brought in to start with and then enforcing it. But really, you can see that the vulnerability of that movement for change that needs more than ever to have, you know, global donors, global leaders, really ensuring that commitment and action to change is sustainable. And within the world of development, that sustainability of commitment and resource is always highly fragile. And I think that's part of the problem that we see in Gambia, is that COVID really opened up or rather triggered a kind of repeal of aid funding, which I think also weakened the movement for change in places like the Gambia. So there were multiple factors, but I think we need to really recognise that, unfortunately, social change is always going to be met by a backlash, and we need to be ready for it.
And many contentious issues. And what you're saying with the COVID example is, when people were in lockdown for months on end, it meant there'd be less monitoring of what's going on in private spaces. And so people who are culturalists were then able to use situations like that to resort back to culture. And once the momentum is there, it's hard to get people to move back. And then politically as well, when governments change for whatever reason, and more conservative elements come into the fray, then there's a confluence of issues. And if you add to that conflict and displacement and migration issues, where people find themselves now displaced and living in refugee camps, who then starts to monitor the individual at that very personalized level? And this is why Dr. Sibusiso Mkhwanazi and Leandra Hubert at the Institute for Global Studies have done quite an extensive report on the rise of female genital mutilation in South Africa and the rest of Africa in this day and age. Instead of seeing a reverse trend, we're seeing now an increase in FMG. The World Health Organization, as you said, there's a global advocacy that's growing around this issue, and they've deemed female genital mutilation violence against young girls. They've identified four types. For the sake of our listeners, I won't go into depth because it's quite graphic as to what we mean by it. But they say there's four types, from the burning of genitalia to what they call infibulation to excision, and then what is more common, which is clitorodectomy, or, if I may, the cutting of the clitoris for the young girl as part of this journey to womanhood. And as you've said, Professor Bradley, the whole idea around the female genital mutilation, when they do these things to her body, is that she becomes less of a sexual being. So they think by doing these things, they're making her less of a wild sexual being and more of a tame woman, whereas the reverse outcome is sought for men.
Yes, absolutely. And it comes back to my previous point about, really, it's about communicating a message to young girls around their inferiority. They must remember their place in society. They must not strive to be powerful human beings. They must not strive to have a voice. Decision making is the domain of men. So again, it's the way in which these practices are used to communicate those deeper and more long-term views that then shape, or limit rather, life expectations.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
So what can we do to raise awareness? I mean, because like I said, in South Africa at the moment, in Southern Africa, this is what we call the period of men, the rites of passage of men transitioning from boyhood to manhood. It's practiced by many cultures across the country, but we seldom talk about what's happening on the other side. And that's really because I didn't know that it was quite prevalent in South Africa, but I definitely read that it was prevalent in countries like Guinea, Somalia, Djibouti, even in Kenya. So it is even worrying to hear that in parts of South Africa, FMG is practiced.
And in many parts of South Africa, it's actually the categorization of type 4 that's quite prevalent, which is labia elongation. And I think, you know, there's growing evidence that labia elongation needs to be regarded equally as a form of violence alongside types 1, 2 and 3, which tend to get more of a focus. So it's just to raise awareness around, you know, quite high levels of prevalence, but because it's not considered to be so bad, it isn't actually captured in prevalence surveys in the same way as the other types. But in terms of what do we do about it, we have to now increasingly focus on challenging the harmful gender norms that ultimately trigger both male circumcision and female genital mutilation. It challenged these ideas that somehow boys are more superior than girls and therefore need to be socialized and strengthened in a different way. I think it's only when we finally, and we will get there, get to a place of gender equity and that level of societal transformation that we will then see an end to these forms of violence. So it's okay. Education. We can already see that educating boys and girls, educating them together through the language of rights, is working.
Okay.
So we need to have hope and support them as they grow into adults, that they will make different decisions for their children.
Yeah. Professor Tamsin Bradley, co-director of the Centre for the Advancement of Equality, Gender and Inclusion Studies at the University of Portsmouth, talking to us about circumcision. And of course, we began this with the wail of a mother in Philani Bubu's song, Kula Kwetini.
4 weeks had passed since he took his rite of passage up the hills, down the valley to become a man. 4 weeks, a mountain of anxiety, a mother's sleepless nights. On the inside strong, on the outside vulnerable. Is this what it takes to become a man? Slash skins, fallen foreskins.
And is this what it takes to become a woman?
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.